We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with the state. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover this morning, starting with, we don't often praise articles in The Stranger, but starting with an article in The Stranger this week.
Yeah, they've got a good one this week.
Yeah, this week, the name of the article is called The Long Con, and it's about what the local branch of the FBI and the Seattle Police Department are doing with the vast amounts of resources that are being allocated to them by the federal government to pursue anti-terrorism cases. And, of course, what are they doing with that money? Well, as it turns out, they're doing a version of COINTELPRO 2. Essentially, they're following people around in the activist community trying to capture what they call domestic terrorists. And for the most part, they're not being very successful. And the article tracks a case in which they entrapped someone who actually was a friend of mine.
I knew him also, former lead singer for Chicago.
Yeah, and I'd wondered for years what had happened to him. Well, it turns out he's been sentenced to 4 years in prison in Colorado, essentially on set-up charges. But what really surprised me about the article, what really got me, was the SPD was part of the investigation. And while the FBI was focusing on quote-unquote domestic terrorists like the Earth Liberation Front and animal rights activists, local Seattle Police Department was focused on an anti-corruption investigation of two of the most liberal members of the Seattle City Council, Peter Steinbrook and Nick Licata. And when I saw that, I thought, holy cow, who authorized the Seattle Police Department to use so many detectives and so much in resources to go after essentially these non-existent problems with the two most liberal members of the Seattle City Council? When in the article, the author quotes a discussion he had with Nick Licata, saying that Licata called then acting police chief, and who is now the current police chief, Diaz, and asked him, you know, what are these detectives doing? And Diaz acted like, oh, they were a bunch of rogue detectives doing things on their own. And that's bull. That is utter bull. No rogue detectives. You don't have more than a dozen rogue detectives spending overtime and that much in police resources to pursue two city council members without authorization from the police chief or somebody even above him. So my question is, I want to know who the heck authorized that and why that was going on.
Yeah,
and why no one knew about it.
And meanwhile, they're spending literally millions of dollars on, for example, deploying entire SWAT teams to monitor ordinary meetings of a handful of activists who, you know, talk about perfectly ordinary and perfectly legal things. It's a staggering waste of resources.
Yeah,
and there's a...
And to put four activists on trial for engaging in what was a private card game for penny ante stakes, you know, I mean, something like that, to me, that's a complete waste of taxpayer resources.
Which, by the way, that penny ante card game is perfectly legal everywhere in the city, everywhere in the area except within the city limits of Seattle.
Well, and you can argue that a private card game is legal regardless of where you have it.
Yeah. But the real lesson here in terms of the activist end of this story, and I have to be very careful what I'm saying here, because I'm working for a campaign that's trying to elect a fairly liberal person to Seattle City Council. Mm-hmm. I can see her or me being investigated in one of these incidents in the future.
If you're not being investigated already.
If I'm not being investigated already. Yeah, I was wondering what that guy was doing with all that cash. Yeah, it really is a lesson for activists out there that if somebody comes wading into your organization, throwing around a lot of money and offering to pay for everything and continually trying to egg you on into doing stupid things and dangerous and violent things that you wouldn't ordinarily do, which was exactly the scenario in this case. And most of the people here had the sense not to do those things, but they didn't have the common sense to look at this guy suspiciously and say, what's the deal with this guy?
Yeah,
he turned out to be a police officer.
Yeah, why did these
and,
things not
you know,
add up?
Similar to the FBI entrapment issues that we've talked about with with Muslim Americans, like the teenager in Portland, where they're getting them and providing them with all the resources to carry out these plots they would never otherwise carry out. It's exactly the same type of expenditure of enormous resources in order to create crimes that would not otherwise have happened. And, you know, if you find yourself in an activist group doing perfectly legal, constitutionally protected things, you know, petitioning the government for a redress of your grievances and all that, and somebody comes along trying to get you to do, you know, violent, destructive, illegal things, and they have a lot of money, stay far away from that person.
Yeah. And, you know,
and let other people know that there's a problem.
And, you know, we talked about this a while back when George W. Bush first took office, even before September 11th, when the FBI had he had ordered the FBI under John Ashcroft at the time to switch their emphasis from, you know, pursuing serial killers and prostitution rings and so forth to go and, you know, and finding lost children, et cetera, and going after what they termed domestic terrorists at the time. This is even before September 11th.
We talked on this program quite a bit about the creation of joint federal local domestic terrorism
on partnerships task forces with local police agencies.
And this was the danger.
We warned about this, that activists would be a target, and here we have a local case right now.
And not only activists being a target, but liberal members of the local city council also.
The fact that it's influencing local politics, that is the most disturbing aspect.
And bear in mind also, Nick Licata for several years was the chair of the Public Safety Committee on City Council.
Exactly.
And a lot of people within the Seattle Police Department did not like his stewardship of that committee, and fairly or not, this can be characterized as payback for that.
Yeah,
and,
you know,
and that's a whole can of worms that you shouldn't even have to think about opening.
Yeah, and I would like to see not just a local activist, but I'd like to see a local politician, perhaps one of the people who was involved in the investigation, like, for example, City Councilman Nick Licata, request information from the police department and try to follow up and find out what the heck was the cause of this kind of thing, what set off this investigation, who authorized the use of these resources. Somebody should be looking into that.
So again, The Long Con, the current version of the edition of The Stranger, go and check it out. It's online.
Mm-hmm. And it's written by Brendan Kiley.
Yes.
All right. Let's move on. Governor Gregoire signing a bill this week that does not...
Yeah, that lowers the penalty for any government agency that doesn't comply with public records requests. Now, the previous penalty was what previous penalties could fall within a range. The minimum, though, was $5 per day. For state agencies that withheld records from citizens who file public records requests. Gregoire signed a law this week that sets the range from $0 up to $100 per day, which means that state agencies could get away with paying nothing if they violate public records requests. Originally, the bill was set with a maximum of $500 because the people who introduced the bill thought that it was important to increase the penalty for agencies that don't comply. Gregoire, on the other hand, and her allies in the legislature said, oh no, that would cost the taxpayers money. So they came up with this so-called compromise legislation that would essentially let agencies escape without even a slap on the wrist. It does not bode well for an open government. When you combine that with a lot of local government agencies that are increasing the costs for activists to obtain copies of information through public records requests by charging them for photocopies, charging them for copies of CDs and DVDs, and increasing the charges on an annual basis. That, to me, that really is not good for an open democratic government.
Yeah, and one of the worst arenas for obfuscating public records requests has been law enforcement, and particularly locally the Seattle Police Department. So once again, it's the case where Gregoire is looking out for her allies in the law enforcement community at the expense of open government.
And she ought to know better. I mean, she is an attorney, and granted, if she files a lawsuit, she can get free copies of information, but the average citizen shouldn't have to file a lawsuit in order to get what is supposed to be open public information from a government agency.
All right. Moving on. Tim Iman, another initiative on the way?
Yeah, surprise, surprise. He has one or more every year because, well, frankly, that's his paycheck. But the one that he announced for next year, not particularly dangerous, it's just kind of stupid, would require that legislators rather than a commission that pays attention to this sort of thing, be the organization that sets the tolls for highways, bridges. It also bans using money for other projects, which is sort of like telling a bank that when you deposit its money, you can't use that money for everything else. You have to hold it for that person. I mean, the idea is to make it logistically more difficult for governments to raise tolls on highways, which is, wrong-headed on any of several levels. But, at the most basic level, it counts on a fundamental voter misunderstanding of how government budgets work and how funding for highway projects work. The money goes into the general fund. The idea is that you turn around, invest it, and you use that investment in order to help pay for the projects as well. But Iman has been on a crusade for the last several years of a pro-roads and anti-enforcement of laws having to deal with roads crusade. So this is another extension of that.
All right. Moving on. Developments with medical marijuana this week.
Yeah, after Governor Greg Barr's partial, which is to say mostly veto of the medical marijuana dispensary bill that was passed by the House and Senate in Olympia this year, Senator Gene Cole Wells of Seattle was the primary sponsor of that bill, has issued a revised bill that is going to be considered during the special session. It would essentially calls Governor Gregoire on her bluff by getting around the reasons that Gregoire stated for vetoing portions of the bill. It would set up a nonprofit collective of pot gardens regulated at the local level, so it gets state employees off the hook, and it takes the for-profit motive and the dispensary business model out. Now the problem with this is that Gregoire has said that she's okay with this revised bill, but that she would only support it if all four leaders of the House and the Senate, that is to say both the Democratic and the Republican leaders, sign off of it. And the Republican leaders, it's not that clear that they will in fact sign off on it. So even though Gregoire says she's okay she may have done that in the knowledge that it's not going to be considered anyway. So we'll have to see where it goes.
All right. Well, moving on to national and Republicans and H.R. 3. What is H.R. 3?
H.R. 3 is a bill that fortunately has no chance of being passed in the Senate or signed by President Obama, but it's a very good snapshot of what House Republicans think the major problems in the country are. It's their version of health care reform, which is to say it focuses exclusively on making it much more difficult for women to have reproductive freedom. It basically outlaws employer-based health insurance coverage of abortions. It also, in the course of doing that, redefines rape as forcible rape, although it doesn't define what the word forcible means in this context. But one of the things that it does mean is that statutory rape would not be covered. So there's your Republican America for you. You're never too young to be barefoot and pregnant.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, reports out regarding Roundup.
Yes, this week a researcher, a plant pathologist and professor emeritus at Purdue University drew links between genetically modified food crops, the herbicide Roundup, and widespread crop failures. He said that top U.S. scientists have found that genetically modified corn and soybean crops have been failing in many areas of the United States, and they believe it is linked to the use of these genetically modified seeds that have been altered in order to allow a heavier use of the herbicide Roundup on those crops. Veterinarians and farmers in Midwestern states are reporting very high infertility rates in livestock that eat those crops that are treated, those genetically modified crops that are treated heavily with Roundup. they're reporting something like 20% of their animals failing to conceive and up to 45% of them having stillbirths. Now, I grew up on a dairy farm in the state of Washington, and I know what the what the infertility rate should be. It should be around 1 to 3% in a herd. That's the natural infertility rate. When you have 20%, you know there's got to be an external factor, some kind of pollution, some kind of exposure.
And a very serious one.
A very, very serious one. And when you have almost half your herd having stillborn calves, you know there's a major problem, major pollution problem going on. In addition, and if that's not disturbing enough, in addition, scientists have found a quote-unquote new organism not previously known to science in these same crops and livestock herds. Now, what that means, the scientists don't even know yet. It's so new, they don't even know what this organism is yet. They haven't figured out, you know, they haven't tested it, figured out what it is. They just know that it coincides with these problems in fertility in animals that are eating these crops. So that bodes very badly for, the impact not just on our food supply, but also on humans. Because we're further up the food chain than livestock and corn and soybeans. We all eat that kind of stuff. And I think people should be extremely concerned. Now, if you want to read more about this, you can visit the websites of Food Democracy Now and the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance are both working on this issue.
Very good.
So you're criticizing Monsanto for destroying life, but you don't give them credit because they are in fact creating life as well.
Yeah, a new organism. We don't know what its impact is going to be.
Now, so it's a trade-off.
Yeah, it is. Now, speaking of pollution, there was another study, another report issued this week. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, reported record increases in asthma in the United States among all populations, all age groups, all racial and ethnic groups, you name it, men, women, white, black, Hispanic, children, old people, everyone. For example, 1 in 10 children in the United States now and 1 in 12 Americans of all ages have been diagnosed with asthma. In 2001, it was 7.3%. In 2009, it's now up to 8.2% of all Americans. That's a double-digit jump just in a matter of about 8 years. It's especially higher in children. As I said, about 10% of children now have asthma. And women, it's at 9.7%. higher than for men. Now, that's something you would expect if it was an environmental cause, because any kind of environmental cause for a disease is going to impact the most vulnerable of the population. In this case, people with lower body mass and who are developing, in other words, children and women who have a smaller body mass. In addition, the researchers pointed out that smoking rates are decreasing. In the past, smoking was often thought to be the main cause of asthma in the United States. Clearly, that's not true anymore. It's something else, whether it's polluted air, polluted water, the fact that we're polluting our food supply more, whether it has to do with issues of obesity. These are all things that relate to problems with the environment and problems with our food supply.
All right. Moving on to international, and lots of news this week, obviously, about the U.S. assassination.
Yeah, there was assassination this week that was launched by the United States, an operation that was authorized to assassinate a prominent person on foreign soil in his own house. And I'm referring, of course, to the U.S. assassination attempt on Muammar Gaddafi on Friday night, which was entirely swept out of the news by what happened 24
Wait,
hours later.
I thought you were talking about the other guy. What's his name?
We'll get to Anwar al-Awlaki. That'll come in a minute.
Okay.
But Friday night, the U.S. For the second time, because it also did this in 1986 when a Reagan ordered bombing strike on Tripoli killed one of Muammar Gaddafi's children. This time, NATO attack on a house where Gaddafi was staying, at least according to the Libyan media, killed his youngest son and also three of his grandchildren. This well beyond the mandate of NATO to protect civilians. That's supposedly the rationale behind the current war and the U.S. involvement in that war in Libya. The whole legality and morality of trying to assassinate a foreign head of state whom you are not at war with was not even raised in U.S. media, and that was even before the subsequent assassination. And then, as Maria mentioned also, we had another assassination attempt this week also. That was on Anwar al-Awlaki on Thursday. Awalaki, as some of you may remember, was in the news about a year ago when Obama authorized his assassination, even though he is a U.S. citizen. He was a U.S.-born Islamic cleric now living in Yemen who has got a worldwide following for some of his sermons and has been urging jihad against the United States. And because he's recruiting English language speakers, even though he's not a particularly high-ranking member of Al-Qaeda, he's been targeted by the U.S. Well, they did in fact attempt to assassinate him this week for the first time in nearly a decade using drones in Yemen, and apparently they missed him, but they did wind up killing a number of other people, as with the Tripoli bombing. So again, the United States is very much in the business of assassinating people on foreign soil without any due process. In the case of al-Awlaki, he's a U.S. citizen who has never been convicted of any crime, but the United States president has ordered his assassination anyway, which is a very, very troubling precedent, and exactly the sort of abuse we warned about when George Bush was president, saying that this sort of behavior, this sort of lawlessness where the U.S. president can pick anybody he likes, whether a U.S. citizen or not, and totally circumvent the due process requirements of the Constitution, that's a precedent that is going to be used and abused by future presidents of both parties, and that's exactly what we're seeing now.
Well, and we'll see foreign leaders all over the world taking our lead on this as well and deciding that they can do the same thing.
Yeah, in fact, we already saw that this week, and particularly with the next assassination that we'll talk about, where you had Israeli leaders talking about, well, this, because the United States is doing it, this justifies the policy that we've been following for several years of trying to assassinate Palestinian leaders.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Oh, yeah, and wait, wasn't there that other assassination, the one that was successful this week?
Oh, yeah, they just totally destroyed Donald Trump's reputation at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. That was pretty good.
I was talking about the fellow they referred to as Geronimo, perhaps the single most distasteful operational term I've ever heard used in a United States operation. The fact that they referred to Osama bin Laden as Geronimo I found to be completely disgusting, particularly since I've always viewed Geronimo as a pretty praiseworthy guy.
Yeah, racist and offensive, and you know, there's just not that many different ways you can characterize how really offensive that was.
Yeah. But aside from that, the assassination of Osama bin Laden, I know a lot of people thought it was a good thing on the right, but also on the left. My main reaction to it was, here was this guy living in basically what was a military suburb of the capital city of Pakistan. Essentially, Abbottabad is a suburban town that serves the enormous military base and military college in that town. And, you know, everybody who lives there,
basically the equivalent of West Point.
Yeah, either works for the military or used to work for the military. And the fact that that's where they found Osama bin Laden, and there's every evidence that he'd been living there for a number of years,
not just
a few months, and that it appears now from the most recent reports that the U.S. intelligence services have been tracking him for not just a few months, as they've said, but perhaps much, much longer, is, I think, pretty disturbing. Also, the fact that the U.S. is now trying to claim, well, we didn't know it was him, we sort of suspected it was him, that's bull. Because you have to be asking yourself, if they didn't know for sure it was bin Laden, And then they go in the middle of the night and assassinate somebody. And if it wasn't bin Laden, what were the consequences going to be? What were they going to say if it turned out to be old ex-retired Colonel so-and-so of the Pakistani Inter-Service Intelligence Agency? You know, I mean, come on. They knew this was Osama bin Laden. They knew he was minimally guarded. And they knew that they could get in inside his perimeter being the Pakistani military establishment. So I think it's very clear here that the Pakistani military was protecting him, that the U.S. knew where he was for some time, and that they decided that they were not going to be able to sneak him out and bring him back home, or that they didn't want to sneak him out and bring him back home, that this mission was going to be a shoot-to-kill one.
Yeah, well, it's pretty clear it was a shoot-to-kill one. And, you know, I understand the rationale from that because, you know, any kind of a trial of bin Laden would have been very, very difficult. The U.S. is not a signatory to the ICC. It would be very difficult for Obama to get a fair civilian trial.
It would have strained our relationship with Pakistan beyond the breaking point.
If we thought that the trial of Saddam Hussein was a farce, I mean, bin Laden's trial would have been a circus. And there were operational reasons as well. But, you know, it still comes down to the fact that, you know, the original decision by George W. Bush to characterize this as a war was flawed in several ways. This was not a war. 9/11 and Al-Qaeda's other terrorist attacks were monstrous crimes, not wars, and they should have been responded to that way. Now, in terms of getting bin Laden, this sort of operation could have been done 10 years ago instead of launching two wars, instead of having an unlimited security state apparatus that was erected around the Department of Homeland Security among many other agencies, instead of the massive debt that's been incurred in the spending of literally many trillions of dollars, instead of the million dead people in Iraq, instead of the endless campaigns of fear. But we know why all of these things were done. They were done to make people rich, and they were done for political reasons having nothing to do with the security of the United States. And this is really just a footnote to that entire campaign, because none of it really has been about bin Laden all along.
All right. This leaves us just about a minute left to briefly cover global warming developments.
Yeah, a couple of issues on the global warming front. Most recent issue of Science Magazine has an article where researchers report that they've been studying crop failure since 1980 and that steadily increasing temperatures are lowering crop yields in all of Europe, large parts of Asia, and some parts of Africa and South America, particularly for the crops corn and wheat. And that's ominous because wheat, corn, soybeans and rice make up the bulk of food for the human race. So researchers are estimating that climate change is currently costing consumers and farmers at least $60 billion a year. And as temperatures increase, it's going to be much, much worse. The Arctic Monitoring Assessment Program, which is the scientific arm of the Eight-Nation Arctic Council, also reported this week that Arctic ice is melting much, much faster than expected. Greenland is melting four times faster than in the 1990s. They're now estimating that sea levels could rise by as high as 5 feet within the next century. The previous estimate done in 2007 by the UN said that the maximum would be about 2 feet. And these scientists say that their modeling was a conservative modeling.
All right. Events.
Yeah, several of them today. Of course, for folks who tuned in at 7:30, the Confronting Islamophobia Conference, starting actually, registration and speakers are starting in just a couple minutes, but it'll be going on all day today at the St. Mark's Cathedral, 1245 10th Avenue East on Capitol Hill. And you can see the schedule at www.confrontingislamophobia.org. Today also at 11 o'clock, we talked about, reproductive freedoms being under assault from the right wing, NARAL hosting a Run for Your Rights 5K run walk event that'll be happening at Green Lake. Go check that out. And then Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. at Town Hall, Michael Eric Dyson, the African-American political and radio commentator, will be in town. That would be a very good ticket. $10 at Town Hall, 7 p.m. on Tuesday night.
Yeah, he's a great speaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. Check it out.